Lucas lost the 1988 election. Liberals were hard at work setting up the argument that Bush won because of the racist Willie Horton ads. At a Republican press conference before the election to discuss Dukakis's record on crime, national defense, and fiscal policy, Bush's spokesman showed three campaign ads with Governor John Sununu, Senator Arlen Specter, and former Senator John Tower on hand to answer questions. But the reporters only wanted to ask about the unfairness of the Willie Horton ad based on their entire knowledge of the case, which they had gleaned from Dukakis campaign press releases. Here's a sample of press questions about the Horton ad. Question. Senator Specter, Democrats suggest, Reverend Jackson said it only a few minutes ago, that the Willie Horton situation and the furlough situation bears the opportunity or the risk to polarize the entire country, and that while the Bush Quayle team maintains that this is not something to sow the seeds or bring up bad blood, that this is exactly what's going on and it should be stopped. What do you have to say to that? Senator Specter. Well, as I understand it, Governor Dukakis and his key campaign aides have moved off the issue of racism. Racism just isn't in this issue, just isn't in this campaign. Everybody wants to have security on the streets and in their homes. Question. Senator Specter, to follow up if you can on this Willie, you didn't show us the Willie Horton spot, but you've used it. Don't you think the use of that picture, whether or not it is originally intended, can be seen as a racial overtone to this spot? Senator Specter, I do not think that is a fair characterization. You can judge for yourself. But the Bush Quayle campaign has not depicted race in any way, shape, or form, either as to any culprit from the furlough program or any victim of such a culprit. Question. Senator, I experienced stonewalling from the Federal Bureau of Prisons when I asked about furloughs, and they withheld totally details on transfer furloughs. Point number 9, here on page 3, says that Angel Medrano is not on furlough. Was he not on a transfer furlough, which is one of the furlough programs of the Federal Bureau of Prisons? Bush staff. We can do that right now. According to the Bureau of Prisons, Medrano was not on furlough. Question. Was he escorted? Bush staff. He escaped from a halfway house. Governor Sununu. There's an important point. What was the charge under which Medrano was being imprisoned? Question. That's not my point. Bush staff. It was drugs. He was not imprisoned for murder. Question. Isn't that the exact same thing? Senator Specter. No, that is not the same thing. And then there were 30 seconds left for John Tower to answer questions about national defense. Whatever else voters knew about Willie Horton in 1988, one thing the media didn't want them to know about was his crimes. In the entire Nexus archives for 1988, the only place you will find a detailed description of what Horton did to Cliff Barnes and Angela Miller is in a press conference that Barnes had to hold himself, and where reporters repeatedly asked him if he was a racist. A search for the words Willie Horton and the Maryland couple produces 219 documents on Nexus. A search for the words Willie Horton and Joey Fournier produces 219 documents. But run the words Willie Horton and racism, and Nexus tells you this search has been interrupted because it will return more than 1,000 documents. Reporters were more interested in getting Horton's side of the story. So many reporters wanted to interview Horton that he needed an aide to help him field media requests. Full disclosure, for a brief period in 1989, Willie Horton and I shared the same publicist. Even Horton knew Dukakis couldn't win, though he did support Dukakis for president. Talking about his attack on the Maryland couple In the same abstract way liberals talk about 9/11, Horton said, "It occurred at the most inopportune time for me and Dukakis." And yet, books have been written on how the media played right into Bush's hands on the Willie Horton matter. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, wrote a 3,000-word treatise, which she turned into a book, about how the Bush campaign played the media like a fiddle with the Willie Horton issue, insinuating an entire vocabulary about the campaign into press coverage. For example, Jamieson claims it was a Bush administration dirty trick to get the media to call him Willie Horton. She refers to him only as William Horton, as proof that Willie was a cruel invention of the Republicans. Jamieson cites the following facts. His given name is William. He calls himself William. Court records cite him as William. A July 1988 Reader's Digest article identifies him as William J. Horton, Jr., and press reports prior to the Republican ad and speech blitz name him William. I'm pretty sure what really caught people's attention about the Horton case was his rape and torture of Cliff Barnes and Angela Miller while on furlough from a life sentence, and not that his name was Willie. In any event, except for the claim about what he calls himself, these are all restatements of the same manifestly obvious fact: Horton's given name is William. I assume everyone grasped this without Jamieson's laborious exegesis. Of course, prison records referred to Horton as William, and for that reason so would early news accounts. That's his legal name. Orenthal James Simpson's court records don't refer to him as O.J. Jamieson's only real claim is that Horton called himself William. First of all, how on earth does she know? Did she interview his cell block buddies? Do a phone survey of Horton's surviving victims? Unless Horton is an aspiring host for Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, it doesn't exactly ring true. Bill, we might have believed, but William? No. In fact, in an interview with liberal columnist Jimmy Breslin the day of Bush's inauguration, Horton refers to himself in the third person as Willie Horton. According to Jamieson, another example of the media's pro-Bush bias was the constant reference to weekend furloughs. Jamieson indignantly reports that Horton was actually released on a 48-hour furlough that began on a Friday, which means he should have returned to prison while most of us were still enjoying what we usually define as a weekend. No doubt most Americans would have approved of the furloughs had they realized that. What was invidious about the weekend furloughs phrase, Jamieson said, was that weekend is a time for recreation and leisure. This association suggests that the assault and rapes were leisure activities for the prisoners. In fact, of course, the prisoners spent their furloughs reading the New York Times, having brunch, and taking in a Woody Allen movie at the Beekman like everyone else. Again, I think what people had a problem with was the fact that rapists and murderers were being released from prison at all, not whether the furloughs ended on a Sunday or a Monday. Jamieson was appalled that Bush lackeys over at the New York Times, the Washington Post, NBC News, CBS, and McNeil Lehrer used words like slashed, terrorized, and tortured to describe what Horton did to the Maryland couple. Such words, she said, are not the words usually used by reporters to characterize crime, especially when they're describing counterfeiting, bribery, and fraud cases. Compared with a detailed accounting of what Horton actually did to the Maryland couple, words like terrorized and tortured are sweet euphemism, like saying, Hitler subdued the Sudetenland. Apparently, Jamieson thinks reporters should have said Horton interviewed, met with, or chatted with the Maryland couple. Most peculiar coming from a good progressive like Jameson, she was indignant that reporters did not stress the fact that at the time of the attack, Barnes and Miller were living in sin. According to Jameson, only pro-Bush bias in the press could explain why reporters did not muddy up the victims by pointing out that the couple only married sometime after Horton's attack. She even provided a list of the worst offenders. This was the same press that used some variation of the word racist nearly 10 times more, 295, than Cliff Barnes's name, 30, in news stories about Willie Horton in 1988. While Jameson was indignant about news stories that referred to a 48-hour furlough that began on Friday as a weekend furlough, she seemed to miss media lies that fell more within the accepted definition of lie, such as that Dukakis inherited the furlough program from a Republican governor, or that other states had the same furlough program. In a rash act of journalism, the Lawrence Eagle Tribune, the newspaper in the town where Joey Fournier had been murdered, ran a major series on Dukakis' furlough program. Unaware that good reporting consists of writing about Jeff Gannon week after week, see Frank Rich, or calling Bush Bushy, Maureen Dowd, the reporters produced nearly 200 factual articles about the Massachusetts furlough program. The Eagle Tribune's coverage was widely credited with ending furloughs in Massachusetts for first-degree murderers. Even the Pulitzer Committee broke a long-standing tradition of ignoring good journalism and awarded the newspaper a Pulitzer Prize for the series. Journalism professors attacked the series as the journalistic version of a lynching, in the words of Bruce Porter, a professor at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. There were sleazy maneuvers available to the reporters that they did not use. As an example of the slipshod reporting, Porter noted that the paper never mentioned that furlough programs had been created in 1972 under a Republican governor, Francis Sargent, or that first-degree murderers were ruled eligible for it by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in 1973. For failing to reprint Dukakis' campaign press releases, the Eagle Tribune had committed outrageous errors, or, as normal people would say, it was bristling with facts. The liberal hysteria on Willie Horton was so intense that the lead author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning series disavowed the prize. Susan Forrest, now a reporter with New York Newsday, said she was ashamed of her work on Massachusetts' furlough program. She added that when the prize was announced, there was a party and I didn't even go. Deep down, I never felt I deserved it. I'm sure Comrade Stalin will give her a fair trial. The Democrats ran a man for president who had released a violent lunatic from a prison despite a life sentence. But instead of Republicans raising Willie Horton constantly to say, "This is the same Democratic Party that released Willie Horton," it's Republicans who are supposed to be embarrassed by Willie Horton. The reporter who wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning series on the Massachusetts furloughs, leading to a change in the law, retracted her work. The rewriting of history was complete. Chapter 4. The Holiest Sacrament, Abortion. No liberal cause is defended with more dishonesty than abortion. No matter what else they pretend to care about from time to time, undermining national security, aiding terrorists, oppressing the middle class, freeing violent criminals, the single most important item on the Democrats' agenda is abortion. Indeed, abortion is the one issue the Democratic Party is willing to go to war over, except in the Muslim world, which is jam-packed with prohibitions on abortion, Because going to war against a Muslim nation might also serve America's national security objectives. To a liberal, 2,200 military deaths in the entire course of a war in Iraq is unconscionable, but 1.3 million aborted babies in America every year is something to celebrate. The Orwellian dishonesty about abortion begins with the left's utter refusal to use the word abortion. It would be as if members of the National Rifle Association refused to use the word gun. These pro-choicers treat abortion the way Muslims treat Muhammad. It's so sacred, it must not be mentioned. Instead, we get a slew of liberal euphemisms for baby killing. Reproductive freedom, a woman's right to control her own body, terminating a pregnancy, freedom of choice, a woman's own private medical decision, a procedure, access to health care, family planning, our bodies ourselves, choice. Choice is important when it comes to killing babies, but not so much when it comes to whom you hire, whom you associate with, what you think about evolution, how much gas your car consumes, how much water comes out of your bathroom showerhead. The only other practice that was both defended and unspeakable in America like this was slavery. There are three indirect references to slavery in the Constitution, but the words slave and slavery never appear. The New York Times and the rest of the mainstream media will only refer to partial birth abortion as what its opponents refer to as partial birth abortion. What do its supporters call it? Casual Fridays? Bean with bacon potato chip dip? Steve? Partial birth abortion isn't some meaningless poll-tested name like assault weapon. It's a straightforward legal description of the procedure that is to be prohibited by law. If there were a better name for it, you can be sure the New York Times would use it. The 2003 partial birth abortion ban, enacted by the U.S. Congress and signed into law by President Bush, defines a partial birth abortion as an abortion in which the person performing the abortion deliberately and intentionally vaginally delivers a living fetus until, in the case of a head-first presentation, the entire fetal head is outside the body of the mother, or, in the case of breech presentation, any part of the fetal trunk past the navel is outside the body of the mother, for the purpose of performing an overt act that the person knows will kill the partially delivered living fetus, and performs the overt act, other than completion of delivery, that kills the partially delivered living fetus. As one can see, actual descriptions of partial birth abortion do not tend to help the pro-abortion side. Partial birth abortion is the euphemism. In 1995, 60 Minutes set out to prove there was no such thing as a partial birth abortion. Ed Bradley asked Colorado abortionist Warren Hearn what the term meant. Bradley: what is a partial birth abortion? Dr. Hearn: well, I'm not really sure I know. There's no such thing in the medical literature. Bradley: would most doctors in this country know what a partial... Dr. Hearn: no, there's no such thing. Bradley: it doesn't exist? Dr. Hearn: no. Bradley: so where does this term come from? Dr. Hearn: propaganda term. It's a political term, has no medical meaning. This is as opposed to precise medical terms like choice and back-alley abortions. This is pure sophistry, along the lines of liberals pretending not to know what liberal means. Battery and sexual assault aren't medical terms either. They're legal terms, descriptions of what the law prohibits. The fact that the medical community has not dignified this particular form of infanticide with a name doesn't mean legislatures can't ban it. 60 Minutes also sought to assure viewers that despite all the hullabaloo about partial birth abortion, whatever the hell that is, such abortions were extremely rare, performed only in extenuating circumstances. You know, like pregnancy. Consider the lunacy of both denying that partial birth abortions exist and then discussing the frequency of that non-existent procedure. Bradley interviewed two women who had had partial birth abortions on horribly deformed babies who could not have lived outside the womb. One woman told Bradley, "In terms of misinformation, the biggest one is that there are thousands and thousands of these abortions being done in the third trimester on normal babies with healthy mothers carrying normal babies. Well, if that's the case, where are they?" Yes, indeed. Why aren't more of these dead babies speaking up? In a voiceover, Bradley then said that Helen Alvare, spokeswoman for the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, wouldn't tell us where they are, but she insists they are there. In fact, Alvare did better than tell Bradley where they are. She quoted the man credited with inventing partial birth abortions, Martin Haskell, who told American Medical News that 80% of the partial birth abortions he performs are purely elective. At this, Bradley asked Alvare, "Why is this interview with Dr. Haskell so important?" Bolstering the claim that partial birth abortions are extremely rare, Bradley insisted, "Of the 1.5 million abortions performed every year, only a tiny percentage, somewhere between 600 and 1,000, are performed in the third trimester of pregnancy." To talk only about how many abortions are performed in the third trimester is just another way of lying about abortion. It is like talking about only the number of partial birth abortions performed by left-handed abortionists with hairy moles on their faces. The third trimester begins at 26 weeks. Babies can take a breath outside the womb at around 19 weeks. At 14 weeks, they have eyes, ears, hair, toes, fingers, and fingernails. I think what repels most people about partial birth abortions, or casual Friday, is the fact that that baby is having its brains suctioned out. A few months after Bradley assured viewers that the non-existent partial birth abortion occurs only about 600 to 1,000 times per year, The Record, Bergen, New Jersey, reported that a single abortion clinic in Englewood, New Jersey, performs about 1,500 partial birth abortions every year on babies 20 to 24 weeks old. Contrary to the claims of the women interviewed by Bradley, whose entire expertise was based on having had partial birth abortions themselves, one doctor at the clinic said, "Most are for elective, not medical reasons, people who didn't realize or didn't care how far along they were." With the pro-choicers, even their talking points are lies. It is a point of honor with the abortion crowd to claim that no one is for abortion. As far back as 1978, Corey Richards of Planned Parenthood told Newsweek magazine, "Strictly speaking, no one is for abortion." Carol Werner of NARAL expanded on the point. "The phrase pro-abortion is totally inaccurate. We are pro-choice. What matters is that the option is there so the woman can exercise it." An op-ed piece in the Washington Post in 1989 titled "The Real Issue, Choice," reminded readers, "No one is for abortion." And a 1991 op-ed in the Chicago Tribune argued for a federal law requiring taxpayer money to be spent on abortion counseling, saying, "No one is for abortion. Nonetheless, freedom to terminate an unwanted pregnancy must remain an option, precisely because society has not yet made it possible for all pregnancies to be wanted." By 2005, the claim that no one is for abortion had to be stated as a cliché, as it was in an article in Conscience, a journal for pro-choice Catholics, attacking the bishops for missing this important point. As stated many times by all pro-choice advocates, no one is for abortion, no matter how often and how loudly the bishops and their minions say it. Saying it doesn't make it so, but they haven't figured out anything else to say. After all their prattle about how no one is for abortion, it took about 5 seconds for Mama Alito, magnificent primogenitress of Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito, to smoke them out. Speaking of her son, Rose Alito told reporters, "Of course he's against abortion." And then all hell broke loose. USA Today raised Mama Alito's remark in an editorial demanding straight answers from Alito on his views of the court's established abortion law jurisprudence that keeps the government out of citizens' bedrooms and most intimate decisions. Columnist Ellen Goodman listed as a telltale sign about Judge Alito, "We know what Alito's 90-year-old mother knows. Of course he's against abortion." 5 Democratic congresswomen, along with Marsha Greenberger, co-president of the National Women's Law Center, held a press conference to announce their opposition to Alito. In an adorable statement, Representative Jan Schakowsky cited Mrs. Alito's remark and said, "We trust what our mothers say." It's so cute when the pro-abortion crowd starts citing mothers as moral authority. But wait a minute. I thought everybody was against abortion. What happened to the talking point about how no one is for abortion? Mrs. Alito put an end to that in a hurry. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, "Violence does not and cannot flourish by itself. It is inevitably intertwined with lying." Then there's the canard about a united front of women supporting abortion while misogynist men try to keep it from us. Feminists have a charming slogan memorialized on buttons sold by the National Organization for Women and the title of a book, "If Men Got Pregnant, Abortion Would Be a Sacrament." Apparently, it isn't a sacrament now, only because of the overwhelming hatred men have for women. How about this slogan? "If women had to pay for dates, rape would be a sacrament." It's rather churlish of the Narrall types to complain about men's insufficient support for abortion. Men support abortion more than women do. On the basis of casual observation, single men between the ages of 18 and 30 are strongly supportive of a woman's right to have irresponsible, casual sex with them. Maybe Narrall should work on getting more women to support abortion before attacking the primary beneficiaries of it, or what we used to call CADs. Indeed, it's hard to see how abortion could be any more of a sacrament for some men. Bill Clinton sold out nearly every single Democrat special interest group, also his party, his vice president, his advisors, his wife, his daughter, and his family, but that's another story. There was only one issue Clinton was absolutely committed to: killing the unborn. Congress passed bans on partial birth abortion twice in large bipartisan votes. Clinton vetoed the bills both times. This is a man who took polls to decide what he would do for his vacation. He even relied on a quick show of hands to decide which woman to hit on during stops on the campaign trail. But in the face of huge majorities opposed to partial birth abortion, Clinton's support for the gruesome procedure was unflagging. Say what you will about the man, at least he knows his base. Moreover, if women are so pro-abortion, why are virtually all abortionists men? If ever there was a need for a take-our-daughters-to-work day, it's at the abortion mills. As the male director of a Cleveland abortion clinic explained, Women tend not to enjoy doing abortions over and over for moral reasons. Also, problems arise when the women doctors become pregnant. Not only does a pregnant abortionist tend to upset the patients, but, he said, if a woman is carrying a baby, she doesn't like to abort someone else's. But according to Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat, California, Roe v. Wade is critically important because women all over America have come to depend on it. Leave aside any moral questions about baby killing, a term I have come to understand baby killing supporters dislike. At its most majestic, this precious right that women have come to depend on is the right to have sex with men they don't want to have children with. There's a stirring principle. Leave aside the part of this precious constitutional right that involves, 1, not allowing Americans to vote on the matter, and, 2, suctioning brains out of half-born babies. The right to have sex with men you don't want to have children with is not exactly give me liberty or give me death. In the history of the nation, there has never been a political party so ridiculous as today's Democrats. It's as if all the brain-damaged people in America got together and formed a voting bloc. The Federalists drafted the greatest political philosophy ever written by man and created the first constitutional republic. The Anti-Federalists, or pre-Democrats, as I call them, were formed to oppose the Constitution, which, to a great extent, remains their position today. Andrew Jackson, the father of the Democratic Party, may have had some unpalatable goals, but at least they were big ideas. Wipe out the Indians, kill off the National Bank, and institute a spoils system. Love him or hate him, he never said, "I'll be announcing my platform sometime early next year." The Whigs were formed in opposition to everything Jackson stood for. The Republican Party emerged from the Whigs when the Whigs waffled on slavery. They were pro-choice on slavery. The Republican Party was founded expressly as the anti-slavery party, which to a great extent remains their position today. Having won that one, with 600,000 white men having to die to redeem the principle that all men are created equal, today's Republican Party stands for life, limited government, and national defense. And today's Democratic Party stands for the right of women to have unprotected sex with men they don't especially like. We're the Blacks Aren't Property / Don't Kill Babies Party. They're the Hookup Party. For people who claim to be so concerned with privacy, they certainly don't hesitate to make the sweaty details of their private lives central to the national debate. No Republican is so crazily obsessed with any issue as the Democrats are with abortion. During the debate on the bankruptcy bill in 2003, and then again in 2005, Senator Chuck Schumer, New York, introduced an amendment to the bill that would exclude protesters at abortion clinics from bankruptcy protection. That was the Democrats' main objective in a major restructuring of the bankruptcy laws in America: ensure that fines levied against abortion clinic protesters would not be dischargeable in bankruptcy. It wasn't even a law vaguely related to children or reproduction, like a health care bill. It was a bankruptcy bill. How maniacally insane do you have to be to bring up abortion in a debate on a bankruptcy bill? How about the Defense Appropriation Bill? There must be one abortionist for every 30 men in the field. This would be like Republicans demanding an amendment to the bankruptcy bill, saying you can't discharge money you owe to a gun manufacturer in bankruptcy. The amazing thing is, the abortion amendment to the bankruptcy bill actually was approved by the Senate in 2003 and was only narrowly defeated in the Senate in 2005 by a 53-46 vote. At the 1992 Democratic National Convention, which nominated Bill Clinton, the Democrats wouldn't even allow a pro-life Democrat governor of a large swing state to speak. Governor Robert Casey was the enormously popular governor of Pennsylvania. But the Democrats wouldn't let him speak because of his pro-life views. You might say the Democrats were running that convention like a plantation. And I think you know what I'm talking about, girlfriend. Copyright Hillary Clinton. When Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts was the abortion party's candidate in the 2004 presidential election, he expressly endorsed taxpayer-funded abortions amid a stream of reminders that he had been an altar boy and that religion helped lead him through a war. In the sort of convoluted nonsense Democrats spout whenever the topic is abortion, Kerry said, during the second presidential debate, "You don't deny a poor person the right to be able to have whatever the Constitution affords them if they can't afford it otherwise. Unless, of course, it's a quality education at a non-public school. I have a right to free speech. How about the government buy me a newspaper? Hey, doesn't the Constitution protect my right to travel in a brand new Cadillac Escalade? I'll take a red one, please." After Kerry lost an election in which voters said the most important issue to them was moral values, suddenly Democratic doublespeak on abortion reached epic proportions. Senator Dianne Feinstein began complaining that Republicans were painting the view of the pro-choice movement as abortion on demand, and nothing can be farther from the truth. One thing that could be farther from the truth is something that's untrue. She seemed to have forgotten that the Democrats' presidential candidate stated loud and clear, in a widely viewed presidential debate no less, that he was for abortions at any time for any reason, paid for by the taxpayer if necessary. This is also known as abortion on demand. Former NATO General Wesley Clark was only slightly more explicit than all the other Democratic candidates for president, saying a woman should be free to abort her baby right up until the moment of birth. And consider, Clark might have been the Democrats' presidential candidate if he hadn't been endorsed by Michael Moore. Another abortion party candidate for president in 2004 was Howard Dean, a former medical resident with Planned Parenthood, the largest abortion provider in the United States. During a January 15, 2004 conference call with reporters, Dean, being a raving lunatic, said, "No doctor is going to do an abortion on a live fetus. That doesn't happen. Doctors don't do that. If they do, they'll get their license pulled, as well they should." Yes, you're reading that correctly. At the risk of belaboring the obvious, abortions, by definition, are performed on live fetuses. Otherwise, it's called a miscarriage. After the election, when Dean was campaigning to be chairman of the Democratic National Committee, he said the Democrats should stop turning their backs on pro-lifers. Dr. Demento said, "I don't have any objection to someone who is pro-life, if they are really dedicated to the welfare of children. Conversely, I suppose, if you are pro-abortion and you hate kids, Dr. Dean would be cool with that, too." Things were so bad, NARAL Pro-Choice America even decided not to oppose a bill that would require doctors to anesthetize babies being aborted after the 20th week of pregnancy, called the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act. Planned Parenthood, however, seems to oppose it still. How deranged would you have to be to oppose such a bill? Evidently, the wording of the act contained several unacceptable terms, including unborn, child, pain, and awareness. The word act they were okay with. The pro-abortion zealots demand that the Democrats swear absolute fealty to their craziest positions, and generally the Democrats are happy to comply. They need the money. In 2004, pro-abortion groups gave over $1.4 million in hard money to candidates for national office, more than twice as much as did pro-life groups. Emily's List is a political fundraising group that gives money only to female candidates who support abortion. In 2004, Emily's List raised $34 million. By comparison, the National Right to Life Committee raised only about $1.7 million. Showing the raw principle of the modern Democratic Party, among the Democrats who have abandoned pro-life positions to become pro-choice are former President Jimmy Carter, Senator Dick Durbin, former Representative Richard Gephardt, Representative Dennis Kucinich, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, and chubby nutcase Al Gore. All but Durbin have run for president. It's easy to imagine a person going from being pro-abortion to anti-abortion based on new information. Ultrasounds, medical advances, pictures of babies smiling in the womb. But it's hard to see how new information could produce the reverse conversion. Everyone knows it's a terrible thing for a woman who doesn't want to be pregnant to be pregnant. But Al Gore explained his conversion experience, saying he had talked to a lot of women who taught me about the kinds of circumstances that can come and the kinds of dilemmas that women can face. Only for a Democrat could that constitute new information. How about, I talked to a lot of plantation owners and I found out they really do need slaves to pick the cotton. Still, despite the massive infusions of money, the Narol ladies keep failing to produce the votes needed to win an election. The problem for the Democrats is that give me liberty or give me the right to have unprotected sex just isn't that inspiring a rallying cry. Republican presidential candidates win historic landslides when they make abortion a central part of their campaign, as Ronald Reagan did. Democratic candidates have to weasel out of defending abortion by claiming they want to make abortion safe, legal, and rare, merely to win a plurality. What other basic constitutional rights do its staunchest advocates urge us to exercise as little as possible? Speech? Free assembly? Not quartering soldiers in our homes? Not surprisingly, polls have shown that being pro-life was more helpful to politicians than being pro-choice. In a 1996 Los Angeles Times poll, 27% of respondents said they were more likely to vote for Bush because he was pro-life, but only 18% said they were more likely to vote for Al Gore because he was pro-choice. The Democrats need pro-life votes, but there's the small problem that they won't budge an inch on abortion. So they make crazy arguments for abortion, allowing not the tiniest restriction, while periodically pretending to have qualms about abortion. It's the most amazing spectacle, as if Ronald Reagan were slashing our taxes while talking about what a sad, tragic choice it is to cut taxes, or giving speeches about how tax cuts should be safe, legal, and rare. Except that even Reagan didn't have the gusto for cutting taxes that the Democrats have for ending human life. It would be so easy for the Democrats to say, okay, we're against partial birth abortion, or we've changed our mind on parental notification of a minor's abortion. But they can't even say that. The Democrats' only hope is to lie and pretend they stand for something other than the right of women to have unprotected sex with men they don't like. For example, the right of women not to commit suicide. During the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for John Roberts, Senator Feinstein said, "As a college student at Stanford, I watched the passing of the plate to collect money so a young woman could go to Tijuana for a back-alley abortion. I knew a young woman who killed herself because she was pregnant. I know a man who killed himself because of high taxes." To find out what Democrats really think about abortion, you have to read The American Prospect or listen to liberal hate radio talking about Republican judicial nominees like Priscilla Owen. This country cannot have a woman on any federal court if she interpreted a law that says a parent has to be notified of a minor child's abortion to mean that a parent has to be notified of a minor child's abortion. That's like the Nazis. Lock your doors tonight, America. One begins to appreciate why Democrats aren't wild about any political system that permits people to vote. Liberals would have no chance of advancing their bizarre policy agenda if Americans were allowed to have a say in the matter. So, they manufacture phony constitutional rights in which the Constitution always sounds suspiciously similar to the ideological agenda of the ACLU. We know what Democrats want to do, but it's suicide for candidates to run on ensuring the right of minor girls to have partial birth abortions paid for by the government without parental notification. This has to be done through the courts. Abortion is the sacrament, and Roe v. Wade is holy writ. This is why we have to have World War III every time there's an opening on the Supreme Court. As long as Roe is the law of the land, elected Democrats can hide behind the Supreme Court's ruling. They rarely have to cast votes on abortion bills because the High Court has removed abortion from the democratic process. All the Democrats have to do is smear any Supreme Court nominee who might possibly vote to overturn Roe and finally allow Americans to vote on abortion. Consequently, the single most important job in the universe for the Democrats is a seat on the Senate Judiciary Committee to protect made-up constitutional rights to things like abortion and the right never to have to see Christians praying. No Democrat from a swing state is allowed to sit on that committee. Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, from the most liberal states in the nation, are in utterly safe seats. Senator Chuck Schumer from New York, Senator Teddy Kennedy from Massachusetts, Senator Richard Durbin from Illinois, Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, Senator Herb Kohl from Wisconsin, and Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin. This leads to the astonishing spectacle of Teddy Kennedy in full dress sanctimony getting all high and mighty with Supreme Court candidates as if the nominee had done something heinous, like drown a girl and walk away from it because he had diplomatic immunity in the state of Massachusetts. Maybe there's a better committee for Senator Drunk Kennedy to sit on, one that does not require constant moral grandstanding from the Democrats. Fortunately for the Democrats, People for the American Way holds the copyright to the words troubling and concerned. I bet Mary Jo Kopechne was troubled and concerned about the senators leaving her trapped in a car underwater while he went back to the hotel to create an alibi. It's hard to imagine any group of people who are American citizens with less understanding of what Americans are like than People for the American Way. Some would say gun ownership is part of the American Way, but that's not what they have in mind. They probably thought it was kind of a corny name, but it was the only way people from the Upper West Side of Manhattan and Malibu could push a left-wing agenda on America by stealth. They believe in the most extreme version of abortion rights, the right to an abortion at any stage of the pregnancy, no anesthesia for the baby, just as George Washington and Abraham Lincoln did. Of course, if most people agreed with people for a small slice of the Upper West Side way, Democrats might have won a majority of votes from the American people more than one time since Lyndon Johnson was president, and that was 20 years ago, when liberals made up Watergate and Jimmy Carter beat the hapless Gerald Ford with 50.1% of the vote. For the past decade, Democrats have rarely been able to get Americans even to vote for senators who might confirm judges who support their loony ideas on abortion. Senator Dianne Feinstein is a great point person for the Democrats on abortion. Unlike Durbin, Kennedy, and Schumer, she's not a hack, she never drowned anyone, and the Anti-Defamation League isn't trying to put her in a lockbox. But most important, Feinstein helps nurture the myth that abortion is a women's issue. Even Feinstein prefers to cite polls as if she were just trying to represent the people of her state and abortion wasn't really that big a cause for her personally. Well, obviously, I come from a state that is 71% supportive of Roe. The American people, according to the latest ABC poll, 60% supportive of Roe. In a 2000 Los Angeles Times poll that surveyed more than 2,000 Americans over several days, 65% of respondents said abortions should be illegal after the first trimester. 72% of women wanted to make second trimester abortions illegal, compared with only 58% of men. More than half of the respondents said abortion should be illegal in all circumstances, or only to protect the life of the mother, or in cases of rape and incest. 57% said they believed abortion was murder. The article describing the poll was bristling with rationalizations from gender studies professors who claimed support for abortion was declining because the younger generation had no memory of the terror before Roe v. Wade. Yeah, okay, maybe. Or maybe it's that support for all liberal ideas is always at its zenith before people figure out what liberals are talking about. This is known as the Howard Dean effect. The opinion in Roe, written by Justice Harry Blackmun, has gone from being a joke to being the centerpiece of American jurisprudence. Liberals pretend to be shocked that then-Judge Clarence Thomas told the Senate Judiciary Committee during his confirmation hearings that he had never debated Roe. This is ridiculous. No one debates Harry Blackmun's opinion in Roe. It would be humiliating, like discussing the plot of a Will and Grace episode. Roe was so preposterous that Supreme Court clerks referred to it as Harry's abortion. Harvard law professor and Watergate special prosecutor Archibald Cox said of the opinion in Roe, "Neither historian, nor layman, nor lawyer will be persuaded that all the prescriptions of Justice Blackmun are part of the Constitution." Stanford Law School Dean John Hart Eli said, "Roe is not constitutional law and gives almost no sense of an obligation to try to be." Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe has said that the substantive judgment on which it rests is nowhere to be found. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg has called Roe an act of heavy-handed judicial intervention and ridiculed the opinion during her confirmation hearings. A lot of people who favor abortion criticize the opinion in Roe, but no one who opposes abortion says, "I'm against abortion, but Roe certainly is a well-argued opinion." The idea that law students sit around discussing the subtle legal reasoning in Roe v. Wade is absurd. No one talks about the legal analysis in Roe because there is none. Liberals wanted abortion, so they discovered a right to it. And yet Thomas is endlessly attacked for responding to Senator Patrick Leahy's question during the confirmation hearings about whether he had ever debated Roe by saying, "Only, I guess, Senator, in the fact, in the most general sense, that other individuals express concerns one way or the other, and you listen and try to be thoughtful." Patricia Ireland of the National Organization for Women justified her organization's defense of President Clinton's sexual harassment after having opposed Clarence Thomas on the grounds that Thomas had told an absolutely unbelievable story of saying that he had never even discussed Roe v. Wade. Michael Kinsley was still blathering in 2005 about Thomas's outright fib, even perjury, to denounce the idea of Thomas being nominated to Chief Justice. Kinsley sneers at the claim of Thomas's supporters that he didn't commit perjury because he testified only that he had never debated Roe, not that he had never discussed it. I'll take disgust for 10. There's no there. There's nothing to talk about in Roe. Denounce, laugh at, ridicule, attack? Yes. Discuss? No. For people who pin their hopes and dreams on a right invented out of whole cloth in Roe v. Wade, liberals are real sticklers about what the Bible says. In 2005, the New York Times triumphantly announced that the word abortion is not mentioned anywhere in the Bible. Marshaling its evidence, the Times noted that in the index to the Bible, one can find how many times Jesus talked about the poor, at least a dozen, or what the Apostle Paul wrote about grace, a lot. But those seeking instruction on abortion will not find the word at all. It doesn't have words like child rape either, but that doesn't mean Christianity is ambiguous on the subject. Incidentally, another text that doesn't have the word abortion in it is the U.S. Constitution. It doesn't even have the word privacy. Would that liberals would be as literal when reading a constitution that sets forth specific, enumerated rights as when reading the Bible. Liberals are incapable of extrapolating anything about abortion from commands like, "Thou shalt not kill." But they unmistakably see a right to abortion hidden in the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Liberals can't win on abortion in a frank discussion, so they come up with a series of feints, euphemisms, and stalking horses to promote their most sacred belief. They raise procedural blockades to conservative judges, preferring to put the American people to sleep with long exegeses on the history of the filibuster rather than clearly explaining that what they mean by out of the mainstream is, opposes abortion when a girl can't fit into her prom dress. After the 2004 election, the Democrats took secret polls and determined that they could not defeat Bush's judicial nominees on ideological grounds. The Democrats' own polls showed that referring to Republican judicial nominees as radical right-wing Republicans was the least effective approach. It wasn't the conservative judges whose viewpoints were radical. It was the American people's. Suddenly, nothing made sense anymore to liberals who learned about the world from reading the op-ed page of the New York Times. Abortion fanatics know they can't fly under their own flag, so the Democrats use the blacks to front for the feminists. Whenever you see a Democrat getting all worked up about some egregious violation of civil rights, I promise you, he's not talking about discrimination against a black person. Democrats don't care about race discrimination. They are the party of race discrimination. George Wallace, Bull Connor, Bob Byrd, all Democrats. What Democrats mean by civil rights is the civil right of a woman not to inform her husband she's aborting his baby. The civil right of a minor to have an abortion without notifying her parents. The civil right of a woman to plunge a fork into the head of a child as it struggles through the birth canal because it has a cleft lip. That's civil rights. Before we jettison the living Constitution, how about inventing a constitutional right not to hear Democrats invoke the phrase civil rights when what they mean is abortion? The vicious smearing of Judge Robert Bork, Reagan's nominee to the Supreme Court in 1987, was the Democrats' first open admission that they can't win on abortion in an open fight. Even Democrats knew they couldn't scare people by telling them Bork believed in terrible things like parental notification before a minor has an abortion. America to Democrats. So do we. Instead, they had to make ugly allegations that Bork was an evil bigot who would bring back segregated lunch counters, in Senator Drunk Kennedy's famous phrase. Bork had filed briefs in major civil rights cases and had won the respect of people like Justice Thurgood Marshall. Marshall told Legal Times reporter Stuart Taylor, "I think he'd have been a credit to this court." Marshall complained to Taylor that Bork had gotten a bum deal and had been tarred unfairly as an enemy of black people. Democrats didn't care that they were smearing a defender of black civil rights. The right to destroy human life was at stake. Democrats were stymied in their use of the race card to protect abortion rights when President George Bush, 41, nominated Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court the next year. The feminists had to call in Anita Hill for a last-minute Hail Mary smear of Thomas as a sexual harasser. To preserve the right of women to have sex with men whose babies they don't want to carry, the Democrats nearly derailed the appointment of the second black justice ever to sit on the highest court in the land. That's their commitment to civil rights. Hill was believed to be lying by two-thirds of the public. Liberals rewarded her with fawning profiles and a Woman of the Year award from Glamour magazine. But the most outrageous example of the Democrats using blacks to front for abortion rights was their ugly racial attack on Judge Charles Pickering. What the Democrats did to Pickering tells you all you need to know about how they use black Americans to protect abortion rights. As a young prosecutor in the 60s, Pickering worked closely with the FBI to go after the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi. In 1966, he testified against Klan member Sam Bowers on trial for murdering civil rights activist Vernon Dahmer. After testifying, Pickering and his family needed FBI protection. The Klan later claimed credit for defeating Pickering when he ran for the state legislature. Unlike all the Democratic members of the Judiciary Committee, who would later accuse Pickering of racism, he sent his children to the Mississippi public schools, where it was fairly certain they would run into black people. Pickering's real crime was that he was anti-choice. In 1976, he chaired the subcommittee of the Republican Party's Platform Committee, calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn Roe v. Wade. As a state senator, he voted to support a human life amendment to the Constitution. And as the president of the Mississippi Baptist Convention, Pickering presided over a meeting where the convention adopted a resolution calling for legislation to outlaw abortion. His most virulent opponents were People for the American Way, NARAL, the National Women's Law Center, and the Alliance for Justice. NARAL President Kate Michelman declared that Pickering has an open hostility to a woman's right to choose. The feminists wanted abortion on demand, so blacks in Mississippi were told to take a back seat. The Democrats used their Goebbels big lie tactics to claim Judge Pickering had lowered the sentence of a cross burner because he hates blacks. It didn't take a lot of investigation to get the real story. Even 60 Minutes did it. Pickering's objection to the sentence in the cross-burning case was simply that a wildly disproportionate sentence was being requested for the least culpable defendant. The government struck a deal with two of the cross-burners, letting them off with misdemeanor convictions and no prison time. During the proceedings, it became apparent that the government had made deals with the wrong men, including the ringleader of the attack, who had a criminal record, and had once shot a gun into the cross-burning victim's home. After letting two defendants off with a wrist slap, the Department of Justice wanted the third defendant